Thank you. So this is aiming to be a little bit interactive. We're going to start by introducing ourselves. I'm really excited at the quality of this panel. We've got a bunch of really deep experts in different parts of internet censorship, and it's a field that has a bunch of nuance and subtlety that we don't necessarily think about initially until we've sort of really gotten into the weeds of what's going on there. And it is a field that's changing a lot. So we're going to, I think, start by introducing ourselves, and maybe the first question that we'll sort of try and address is what's new in the specific little subfields of censorship that each of us work in. And then we'll sort of dive into a few of the questions that come in there and then open it up to the audience questions at the end. I'm told there is one microphone sort of in the center of the room. So if you have dying questions sort of in the area of internet censorship, and what we mean by that will probably become clear over the next half hour perhaps, feel free to stand in line there and we'll take questions sort of later in this hour. So why don't we start with Roya, and then we'll move down. So can you introduce yourself and tell us, you know.
My name is Roya Ansafi, and I'm a new faculty member at University of Michigan. In my lab, we try to develop new techniques to measure network interference and deploy these techniques and gather the data to understand the behaviors of the intermediaries which does the interference. And then, based on our understanding, try to come up with the ways to defend users from hostile networks. Network interference or censorship, it's a very complex problem. There are many stakeholders, and there are many reasons that the connection can be interfered. For example, from the users to the server, where they provide the service, there are ISPs of the users, there is a government's firewall, let's say, there is a transit network, and then there is an ISP of the server and the server itself. And each of these intermediaries can have their own ways of blocking or interfering with the data. So in my group, and actually my research has been tried to give a fair attention to each of these parties, because one of the key challenges that we have had over the past years is like we have been focusing on the government side of censorship, studying certain countries like Iran, like China, countries that we call suppressive regime, let's say. But internet censorship and discriminations towards users is a very, very broad phenomena. Because of the crowd's interest, the shift has been towards these certain countries. But I'm trying to change the landscape and say that, hey, we should be interested to know, is there a censorship or is there different treatments towards users happening in countries, let's say Western countries. Like, are we interested to know what type of contents Australia is blocking? And so it's really hard to get attention towards those when everybody wants to these days hear about Russia or China or Iran or things. So type of research that I have been focusing on is a server-side blocking. There is a reason for certain servers to offer their service to the certain locations. Because, for example, if you are having a limited bandwidth and you want to have a certain number of clients, so you focus on a certain clients that they bring revenues towards your product. So we have seen more and more servers trying to block a certain countries. And unfortunately, these countries are often poor countries. So we have been studying that phenomena recently more and more. We want to understand why a server discriminates towards the location of the users and what type of server does that. What else? Another type of work that I have been focusing on is what to measure. For any censorship study, we have an input list. And in this input list is currently being maintained by most of the censorship studies using Citizen Lab's censorship list. And that is a crowdsourced basically list of the domains that there is block somewhere or somebody thinks that is going to be block. And it's maintained by activists and civil society. But you can easily see that that is already biased. So because there are certain activists in certain countries more active than the others. And so there are efforts to be able to keep that list updated, try to reach out to many people around the world and try to get them to contribute to that list. But I think in my group, we are trying to come up with the techniques to keep the human out of it. Is there a way that we start from 5 billion domains and we can run measurements globally and use some machine learning techniques to be able to find certain domains that each country is sensitive about and basically have this list started from a very unbiased or naive input. Am I done?
I think that's about 5 minutes. Why don't we? Yeah, okay. We'll get more questions.
Right? Okay. So.
Lex, do you want to go next?
Sure. Cool. So my name is Lex. I'm a researcher at Citizen Lab, which is based at University of Toronto. Our research is broadly focused on the intersection between technology, human rights, and global security. My background is actually in law, not tech, and I've sort of been asked to provide a bit of context on the sort of Western U.S., Canadian context around censorship and freedom of expression, right? It's twins. So just to sort of set the table, I guess there are three things I want to focus on. The first is, you know, how to hold companies accountable when they engage in the international sale of filtering and censorship technology, which is a big emerging problem that we don't have fantastic answers to. The second is I want to highlight some of the sort of messy and emerging problems coming out of freedom of expression law in the West, particularly around jurisdiction. And then the third piece is just to reassert or to keep on the table the continued importance of encryption and anonymity tools, even in Western countries that are under the impression that they don't limit speech or engage in censorship. On the first piece, I think it's essential to say that Western countries and Western companies are in the business of building and selling the infrastructure of surveillance and censorship. Understanding that issue is a big piece of the core of Citizen Lab's work in a lot of ways. So this technology is often called dual-use technology based on the ostensible view that there are legitimate use cases for tools that filter, censor, survey, monitor people. But the technology is also used to facilitate, as we know, really profound human rights abuses. So in April of this year, Citizen Lab released a major report called Planet NetSweeper, focused on a Canadian-made technology called NetSweeper, which is used for institutional filtering, mostly in North America. So things like so that libraries don't have access to pornography, right? But it's also sold to nation-state level ISPs in many countries. We identified 30 countries, and we did a smaller sample of 10 specific ones where there were particularly significant international human rights law issues. Our technical team found that NetSweeper technology was being used to filter religious content in Bahrain, political speech and campaigns in the UAE, journalism in Yemen, and in particular, a large chunk of LGBTQ-related content that was either miscategorized or overcategorized as quote-unquote alternative lifestyles. And that was a list that NetSweeper itself is engaged in curating to some degree, which means that things like access to information about HIV/AIDS health information or even just political advocacy around queer issues is being censored in a large number of countries, and countries where those populations are subject to significant forms of repression and human rights abuses. So what's more is that the Canadian government itself is bankrolling this company to some degree. They're providing them research and development funding. They're taking them on trade missions. And this is, from our perspective, a sort of hypocritical issue for a government that has largely promoted its commitment to human rights and particularly to LGBTQ groups, minority groups and women internationally. So there's a policy cohesion problem there. But there's also this broader issue that businesses have, it's clear that businesses have a responsibility to respect human rights in the countries where they're operating. What's less clear is how to actually hold them accountable for those human rights issues. It's a tricky problem of jurisdiction. The way that we treat, for example, mining or extractive industries or you know, companies that use child labor, other types of human rights issues, aren't as well translated in the technological context, and we need to start building out that legal infrastructure, and we just haven't yet. The other front I want to talk about in some detail is you know, the messiest issues in emerging speech law in the West are really questions around remedies, legal remedies. And I guess the way to do that is to tell you a little story. Well, actually, here's the thing, right? We have this idea that the debate in the West around freedom of expression is really about what the nature of the right is. And there is this mythology that the United States, because of the First Amendment, has this very sort of pure free speech absolutist position. And that, you know, the EU, there's sort of a spectrum where the EU is more constrained around issues like hate speech or reputation, as we see in the right to be forgotten debate. I'm not convinced that that's true at all. I think that it's just a different set of values that are being protected in the US legal context, and those are, in particular, morals around sexuality, which is how we see the mass censorship through legislation like SESTA FOSTA, which EFF is doing a lot of campaigning around, as well as copyright, which, you know, like the DMCA is one of the most powerful, you know, content removal tools there is from a legal perspective. So I think that we just need to think about that, that really there's sort of a debate about the rights, but the bigger, messier, more problematic debate is actually around the remedies, what you do to enforce those rights when they're brought to a court. So there's a case called Equistec, and to really highly simplify it, essentially a couple years ago, there was a case in a British Columbia that's a Canadian court, where the defendant basically was accused of ripping off some networking equipment, running away from a previous employer, starting their own company, and they were sued for breach of trade secret. So it's an intellectual property right. Essentially, the defendant either never showed up or sort of stopped appearing in court, sort of started running a clandestine business, was not available to appear, and it was impossible to take their services online. So they were just basically selling these kind of rip-off, like, sort of router-type devices. The plaintiff essentially seeks an injunction to stop them from doing business online, right, as part of an interlocutory remedy. So the court awards this remedy, but the defendant is nowhere to be found, the court can't enforce the order, and they keep engaging in the offending activity. So then the plaintiff goes to the court and seeks an injunction against Google to have Google remove search results related to this business worldwide. So Google had already been doing voluntary enforcement for .ca, but they're like, well, look, our business is international. Enforce this injunction internationally against Google. So, you know, this ends up being really a case about the remedy itself. It goes all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court. The Canadian Supreme Court ultimately upholds the injunction against Google worldwide. And then Google has just quite recently gone to a U.S. court to ask for sort of an exemption from the ruling of the Supreme Court in Canada, if that makes sense. So it's really like the most complex, messy conflict of laws problem that you can get. And really it's a debate about, you know, if we accept that a Canadian court can tell Google what to do and what content to show people worldwide, do we also accept that a Turkish court or a Bangladeshi court or a British court can decide what other people can see worldwide? So it's a question of really, on one hand, the risk of a balkanized internet, or on the other, the risk that there's sort of a global race to the bottom in terms of freedom of expression. And both are terrible outcomes. And the law does not have fantastic solutions for how to deal with it. So I think that this is something that's worth keeping on the agenda. We often have this idea, these panels often get to like, censorship is bad, you know? Great. You know, but we really have to start thinking at the technical level, at the legal level, at the political level, how we're going to sort of negotiate these complex value problems as well. And I guess on the last piece, I want to say that the encryption debate is far from over. You know, at a sort of legal level, there are new efforts in courts every day in countries like Canada and the US and the UK to expand powers to compel people to disclose passwords. Australia has new proposed legislation that's extremely problematic. And so when we talk about censorship, we also really have to think about the technological mechanisms that help guarantee people's fundamental rights and freedoms on the internet. And that includes tools like Tor, it includes encryption tools, and in particular, end-to-end encryption. So, yeah, there we go.
Perfect.
Thanks, Will.
Thanks, Lex. Sergey.
Hello, thank you for coming. My name is Sergey Frolov, and I'm a PhD student at University of Colorado in Boulder. where we research various practical ways to actually circumvent censorship. My main academic project is a refraction networking family of the circumvention tools, and it tries to move routers into the middle, circumvention routers into the middle of the network. So if we get deployed with the friendly ISPs, then it would be much, much easier to circumvent censorship because requests to arbitrary websites, various websites that have any routers of refraction networking on the path, then we would be able to catch their specially tagged request and start proxying, thus circumventing the censorship. So I'd like to talk about some recent events that happened in various countries. Can you start slides?
Sure.
Okay, so one fun story is how Russia blocked Google and Amazon IP addresses. At some point, they were blocked up to 16 million IP addresses, which is a huge lot. Currently, I think it's like something 3.5 million IP addresses, so still a lot. But the gist of the situation was that they were basically trying to force Google to collaborate with them while trying to ban Telegram. So Telegram would just, you know, do usual things like switch VMs and get new IP addresses, and censors were like, we don't want to hunt those IP addresses one by one, we just want to block the whole subnetworks, and they did. And eventually, and yeah, at some point they Google and Amazon caved to some of the network, some of the censors' demands. Yeah, please forward. So, and does anyone know what domain fronting is? Yeah, a lot of people. So domain fronting was a very crucial defense against enumeration attacks, right? So imagine tools like Tor, they have some public entries, then they have bridges that are sort of private, but there remains an issue of how do you deliver those bridges to users and not the censors. And turns out this is a really, really hard problem, and you have to have lots of bridges, which they don't have, to do that efficiently. But domain fronting allowed a user to establish connection, say, to CDN or to google.com. And through google.com, you could, it would look to a sensor like you're establishing connection to google.com because you're using its IP address and google.com in subject name indication. But then you would request your host name, and you could set up proxying this way. And you're renting from Google something like myproxy.appspot.com, but you go to Google, and then from Google you go to your proxy and then out. And this was a crucial defense against enumeration attacks because now sensor sees that request goes to google.com, but it couldn't just start blocking all the google.com addresses. And this was an issue for sensors for a couple of years, but domain fronting is almost dead at this point. And as the slide says, Amazon and Google turned it off. It still works at Azure, but I wouldn't hold my breath on it remaining the case. The repercussions were horrible. Domain fronting is one of the two current main transport for Tor. One of them is ApfS4, which is also end of life. And the other one is MIG, which uses domain fronting. And MIG Google wasn't an option for a year, I think, but MIG Amazon was an option until very recently. And Tor isn't the only one who was using domain fronting for circumvention. For example, Signal was using it as well. And as you can see, Signal was using domain fronting at Amazon's premises, No, at Google's premises, then they got kicked out, then they went to Amazon, then they got kicked out, then to yeah. And eventually, as you can see, Maxi just turned it off. And yeah, no circumvention for you. And as I've mentioned, key property of domain fronting was enumeration attack resistance. And I want to talk a bit about how can we replace it now. So Snowflake is a new, currently under active development, pluggable transports for Tor. And the funny thing is that it also relied on domain fronting in some way, but yeah, they are finding some other ways to do this rendezvous. And so after this first initial request, client would get, let's go from the other way. So Snowflake is a way to get massive amount of short-lived proxies. When users would go to a website that serves as a Snowflake broker, they would establish WebRTC connections to the clients, to the users in censored countries, and since we are now, and this all would be brokered by the central Snowflake broker. And client and volunteers would talk over WebRTC, and there are potentially many volunteers. It is very easy to set up, so it would be impractical for sensor to block the IP addresses. Now, there are some fingerprintability issues, but we hope those are addressable.
One of the, just to jump in quickly, one of the critical things to mention is WebRTC is the protocol that a lot of video chat uses for peer-to-peer technology. So if you're doing a Google Hangouts or other video chat, this is becoming one of the more common ways that two end-user devices will do a video chat directly between each other. So the thought with Snowflake is allowing arbitrary data of potentially censored content to flow over those same channels and look like you're having a video chat with some random user in an uncensored country before it enters its final destination.
Yeah. Tor actually had a similar transport before. It was called Flash Proxy, but it had a shortcoming of not being able to serve clients behind NAT, and all the clients are behind NAT. Snowflake addressed this issue by using WebRTC. I also want to talk about refraction networking, which is an academic project that we are working on. So as I've mentioned, the idea is that user requests a blocked website. It gets client software requests any reachable site, and the assumption here is that there are at least some American websites that are allowed in censored country. Let's see if this assumption holds. Then censor allows this request to pass through their filters at the border, but then our router that is going to be at ISP partner, IXP partner, CDN, anywhere on the network, it's gonna detect the hidden tag that is that was stapled with the request, and could redirect requests to the blocked sites. I wouldn't go into details about cryptography of decrypting this hidden tag and how can we do it while sensor couldn't. Please do find me after this talk if you're curious, and I would go. And another way to overcome the challenge of enumeration attacks is to just push for massive deployment of easily deployable and usable private proxies. There are a couple of options as of today. So you could use a private bridge, which isn't exactly the easiest solution, but it's the most anonymous one. There is also Outline by Jigsaw, which is a Google incubator, and they use Shadow Socks underneath it, and I think Outline is the leader in usability among those few. There's also Streisand VPN. It supports a lot of great transport underneath. There's also CADI forward proxy, and the benefit of forward proxy is that you're now actually using HTTPS, and it helps you to stay under the radar of the sensor, because sensors usually sort of whitelist HTTPS as opposed to randomly looking protocols like ShadowSox, ApoPhosphor. Yeah.
Cool. That's great. So thanks, everyone. I think there were a bunch of questions that came up. I think there's a couple that we should maybe touch on as a panel before we open it up to sort of broader audience questions. Maybe one of the first ones is if people want to sort of quickly talk about why they see this as mattering to them. I think all of us ended up here because, you know, we care about this field of censorship and freedom of expression. And one of the things that maybe helps relate that is just sort of like what got us, each of us, into this.
I'm Iranian, so by default, when there is some political events happen to Iran, everybody approached me and asked me to ask my friends in Iran to help them run measurement for them. So almost 2012 or so, actually long back before, but anyway, I started to think about the problem differently. I question why we ask end users and activists in different regions to participate in a measurement. Is there any way that we can do measurements from infrastructure machines, from the government's own machine, things like that, so that first we don't need to find people within countries. Also, I didn't want to jeopardize the privacy of the activists within the country by asking them to run a software that is easy to fingerprint. So we started on that project in 2012, and in August 1st, we are going to deploy the project called Sensor Planet. It's run measurement from router, OpenDNS resolvers, Echo servers, HTTP servers, all with the condition that they belong to the government or their infrastructural or organizational vantage points. And that way, we don't need to depend on participation, and we reduce the risks. We have more coverage globally. For each of our techniques, we can have more than 50,000 vantage points around for almost 190 countries. And then we also can run the measurement continually because we don't depend on participation. So the measurement can be weekly, collect the data. And the goal of the project is to hopefully become one of the censorship data repository where activists, political scientists, social scientists come to us, or even computer scientists come to us and say that, hey, we need a data about TCP/IP reachability for this region, and we need it for the past year, and we can provide that. This is a project that does measure internet censorship separately from vantage points, different type of vantage point. And another good example I want to give a shout out to them is UNI, for example. UNI does a great job into involving participations from the volunteers around the world, and they basically, the data they're collecting is a little bit different from us, so we are coordinating and trying to change the landscape. So.
Awesome. And so UNI, the Open Observatory of Network Interference, is within the TOR project, and they'll be talking right after this in the State of the Onion. So if you want more on that, you can stick around.
You can go for it.
I love free internet, and but there's more to it than just being annoyed when government tells you what you can and cannot read, right? It would suck to live in the world where there is overly balkanized internet and you couldn't get access to the information from the other chunks of the internet, and it would lead to pretty bad consequences as far as international relations go, right? Because you would see that the same events would be covered very differently in different parts of the internet. And if only information you can get is, oh, those guys are really bad, and those guys get, you know, the reverse, it's going to generate a lot of hate. The current situation is certainly not ideal, but at least you have a chance to figure truth out. And I want to keep that.
Yeah, I mean, my own motivations for doing this work aren't particularly exciting. Oh, no. Don't get those wet. But I can talk a little bit about what values drive my perspective in this work. I think human rights law historically has emerged from a very liberal, individualized tradition that doesn't recognize fundamentally that marginalized and disadvantaged groups are both disproportionately impacted by this kind of infrastructure of technical control and also suffer disproportionate consequences as a result. And so I feel like in my work, it's really significant to foreground those issues, to point out that the types of content and the types of information that end up being censored are often, you know, that of political resistance movements, you know, movements towards social justice, indigenous justice, women's rights, reproductive rights, healthcare issues, that these are the types of things that are being censored. And that those actually really need to be part of the core discourse from a human rights perspective, from a political perspective. I think that it's been a bit unfortunate that there's been a bit of this, like white boy First Amendment framework for thinking about freedom of expression, because there's a rich terrain there that I think will bring many more people into this issue. And I think that's at the core of what matters to me. And I guess there's maybe this piece around equality too that we wanted to
go for it. Yeah, I mean, I think that definitely ties in, which is, and maybe one other sort of thing to point out in terms of the transition as part of this is, if we were to give this talk, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, when we talk about censorship, we would really be talking about almost an extra-legal nation state. Yep. What are repressive regimes blocking?
Yeah.
And the conversation has evolved a lot. In the West, so much of our content is in platforms, right? There's not as many people who host their own blogs, and so it's about, is Facebook moderating your stream, and in what way? We now have a conversation about fake news. We've really reframed a lot of what we mean by censorship and access to information, and we're having to cope with this public-private space where the spaces that we are engaging in discourse are not commons in a pure way, but are within some corporate framework. And so we have to tackle this question of what is internet freedom and what is equality. You guys have, I think that's probably worth touching on a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've been thinking a lot about this around the Sesto-Fosta debate, right? Which is really legislation, just for folks who are maybe not from the U.S. or not following along, legislation that's been proposed to ostensibly to prevent human trafficking, but also covers the use of the internet to promote or facilitate prostitution, is the language, and in particular makes intermediaries far more responsible for the content they're hosting on their platforms, and really upends the very careful balance that's been struck by CDA 230. And I think that what's interesting about this is that the sort of mass public uproar one would expect is relatively absent, and maybe that's because we're really mostly talking about the rights of women and sex workers, and I think that's a tragedy. And I also think that there's really a missed opportunity here. Something I feel like I've said like 1,000 times this year is that women have other rights beyond being safe on the internet. Like, women are human and have human rights, like speech and privacy, you know, and like we need to stop thinking about these issues as some sort of balancing act or trade-off, but rather as an exercise in affirming and protecting all kinds of speech on the internet. So I think, you know, that's one dimension that I think is often really left behind.
I cannot touch on a philosophical part of internet freedom, but I'm going to just say from a networking perspective, I think internet freedom is to me net neutrality and stuff. Basically, if the network traffic is being disrupted by any means, I want that to be transparent to users and to everybody. everybody. So I think you're free to, as a user, you should be have this freedom to know who is learning about your communication, and if there is some monitoring, there is tampering or blocking, you need to have a very good real-time information about it. I'm going to just a little bit. And we keep talking about internet censorship as a blocking, and I think that's because it's very easy to detect when the communication is disrupted and you don't see what you're supposed to see. So, detecting that phenomena is really easy. But internet surveillance or monitoring is much harder to detect, and therefore much more common. That's also another perspective.
Awesome. So we are getting pretty close to 10 minutes for questions. Why don't we each take a few minutes, or just 1 minute maybe each, to sort of wrap up with final thoughts before we open it up to discussion, so that we still have time for that. I guess I want to end maybe with my piece by following on to what Roya was just saying, which is, there's this access thing in terms of how we talk about censorship. One of the things that has been true and continues to be true is that advocacy around accountability and transparency are the conversation where you can be more successful often. That it's really much easier to argue that if there is censorship, it's a censorship that needs to be accountable to the people, that we need to know what it is. That list should be public, and we need to be able to enforce and monitor and have accountability that the content we can see is within our legal framework and is a conversation we can have. And that's getting there. I think that in many places there are now legal frameworks that drive this, and that means that there is a remedy. There's a way that you can, as a society and as individual nations, have that conversation in the open at least, which is better than it being completely opaque. It's not perfect, but it's one place that we are sort of getting there.
I'd like to, in my final word, I'd like to just encourage you to help with the internet censorship if you have resources or some time. So currently, Tor's pluggable transport effort is heavily defunded, and I'm sure they would accept any help they could get. I would also love some help on refraction networking stuff. Specifically, we are trying to get more deployments, and if you could get your university, for example, to deploy us, that would be really great, and we could research together and write some papers. Yeah, thanks.
I guess just sort of to your point, Roya, I think it's also just important to remember that the technical infrastructure of censorship is often the same or very closely related infrastructure for surveillance, and that these are both pieces of the same puzzle around information controls, and that we have to contextualize them as part of a larger debate around what it really means to be free in the 21st century, and also understanding that these technologies, may not be, foolproof or emancipatory or perfect solutions, but that they create a sort of necessary friction, that makes certain kinds of freedom more possible. And I think that, I was reluctant to talk about what values are really driving me in this debate, but I think that's really at the core of it, and that's a piece that I think we shouldn't lose.
And for a closing remark, I want to emphasize that with the focus of the networking groups on coming up with better techniques to manage network, and with the cheap prices for the deep packet inspectors, we're dealing with a bigger adversary. And therefore, I'm very excited to see that the civil society, activists, academia, everybody has been pushing for research in this regard or transparency and a push for transparency. And I'm actually very optimistic, and I want to thank all of you guys, Citizen Lab, ONI, everybody, that they are going out of their ways to juggle marketing, at the same time working, researching, communicating, trying to bring the community together. We're fighting a good fight.
Great. So we do have some time for questions. I believe there's a microphone. So why don't we see if we get people coming up to it? I will repeat the question, but try and keep it to a single question that we can answer.
With a question mark at the end.
I want just regular comments. Will, you mentioned that we're sort of expanding the conversation about what censorship is, and particularly you mentioned fake news. I wonder if you could talk about that some more.
Yeah, awesome. So the question is about fake news and this sort of current debate about you know, official content, about views, and really what this goes into, right, is that as soon as we go away from purely access, we end up with a much more nuanced debate. And this question of, okay, so maybe there's this one thing of free speech. If I'm in a conversation with one other person, we can talk about whether I should be allowed to say stuff and what bounds are there. And then there's the second question of, what are my responsibilities in giving you a platform to advertise and promote yourself? And where are the limits there? And that's a very different conversation, right? What legal protections we have are, yeah, you can say this, but I don't have to promote it or like support you in saying it. I don't want to necessarily hear an extremist viewpoint. And especially as we end up with this tangled web where most of the content that we're posting, your Facebook stream, is definitely curated. And so Facebook gets to have a curation role in choosing what they promote. And so that has now led to this much more nuanced conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a place that we are in a much worse place in being able to measure because it is so personalized. There's not a single global view for anyone, mm-hmm. and so there's much less ability for us to have accountability. It's unclear if that's something that we can get purely technically. In my opinion, that's going to be a mix, again, of needing to catch up in terms of our policy and legal regimes to have regulation and accountability there, because it's not something that I can easily check for others. That said, I'd love to be proven wrong if people want to develop tools to, you know, be able to monitor their own streams for this sort of manipulation.
I want to add something. When it comes to fake news, this scares me a little bit because in some African countries, for example, we have incidents that the government used DMCA as a way of controlling or removing content. So when it comes to fake news, I'm always asking who's going to make a call if this is a fake news, and that person who's making a call is it needs to be trustworthy.
Next question.
Thank you so much for this much needed conversation. I have a question that was actually related to the last one. When we talk about censorship, often the assumption is that the Western countries and the companies won't be blocking the services. So I'm particularly worried that whenever, sure, we need more transports, more technologies, more protocols, but when we want to deploy these protocols, we have to go to Amazon, we have to go to Google, we have to go to Microsoft. And what if these, I think in this political climate in the US, it's not crazy to wonder what happens if these companies, if the Western governments start to betray the internet and start to not let us to run any of these proxies?
Yeah, I mean, that would be bad. I don't know that I have a compelling answer to that question, but I do want to say there are lots of people in this room who work for Amazon and Google and these types of larger stacks where, and you have a responsibility right now as engineers, as software developers, to be thinking about these issues, to be thinking about the human rights, the human rights that are so intimately bound up with the technologies you're building, and I think take it on an advocacy role within your own companies to prevent that, because there's only so much that can be done from political pressure and lobbying from the outside. There's a lot that can be done in the courts, obviously, on these issues. There are a lot of live legal problems at play, but those are slow and complicated and costly, and so I think that we really need to start thinking more now than ever about our responsibilities as you know, as makers of this technology.
Yeah, sure.
And I would like to highlight that even though Amazon and Google killed domain fronting, they still could be used for censorship circumvention. They are glad to be doing this. They just wanted enhanced protections against domain fronting, which was not necessarily that fair to them.
One point, of course, like these big companies have resources, so it's good that we can depend on them to some degree, but we need to count them responsible. And I think one good example was when Apple didn't accept one of the app that measured net neutrality. They just said that they cannot put it in App Store. But the designer of that app put it on Twitter and asked everybody to call them on it. And I think after 1 hour, it was accepted and it was pushed, because the reputation of a country can be questioned, and that's what we should do. I mean, with respect to domain fronting, I mean, if Google or Amazon doesn't have a good reason for doing so, I think they should be called on. But or if they have, they should be transparent about it.
Yeah.
A follow-up for Will. When you say that there are no tools to do an observation of the personalized stream, there is actually. And tomorrow at the room, Richie, at 20, there is a talk about it.
Awesome.
Also, the question that I want to do on the same subject is if you have a platform that curates for you the stream of the news you are getting, and someone posts a news and you never get it. Is this censorship? Can we call it algorithmic censorship, or which kind of terminology we can find?
Right, so the question is sort of, okay, as we get into individual like items of information, a level up from internet transports and access, is this, I mean, censorship, right? Like news censorship is individual pieces of data or information that are getting taken out of newspapers back in the day, that's the tradition that this is coming from. Censorship has a long, rich history. This isn't a new phenomenon for the internet. And having things that people are attempting to post that don't make it to the audience definitely at some level, especially when it doesn't make it at all, is something that we would say is censorship. The trick and the nuance is when it's just lower on the feed, right? It made it, potentially. It's just not highlighted or promoted. And that's where we get into the tricky part, right? Is does this actually get the intention, and does it fit with maybe the social norms and expectations of users, and how do we have accountability about that? And that's this debate that we're just going to keep coming back to and look for answers and policy around, right?
Yeah, well, I also just think that it's part of the sort of trick that happens where people treat things like Facebook's newsfeed or the Twitter algorithm as like a law of nature, like it's gravity or something, that information just flows in a particular way. And so I think that we need to change the conversation and accept that these technologies, even when they're opaque, are a form of curation or moderation. They embed values and political ideas about what's relevant, what isn't. Once we unpack that a little bit, it becomes easier to have a conversation about the issue you've raised.
Totally. I think we probably have time for one more question.
All right, I'll try to make it good. You know how people like to talk about, like, what's in your bag? What's your daily carry in case things go weird? What is on your computers or phones? I know, like, Sergey's slide showed a variety of tools. Is it just Tor browser? Do you like a certain VPN? How do you avoid, like, if you travel a lot like I do, how do you, what's your, like, loadout? Quick top ones.
Great. So the question is, how do you stay safe with personal digital security, and how do you keep access? I bet a lot of us end up in sort of privileged positions in that I think all of us probably have academic affiliations of some form. And one of the tricks is that in many places, an SSH connection or a VPN to your academic affiliation gets around a lot of blocking. Even in China, the Internet 2 pipe connecting to the various educational institutions has less of a latency addition, so less technically sophisticated censorship can work when you're connecting to an educational location than if you're just connecting out to a standard VPS. So for me, SSH to a server that I own in a place that I trust works great as a bridge most of the time. I will say that when I'm traveling internationally, I'll take a computer that doesn't have things that I consider sensitive. Yeah. So an alternative set of technology for international travel that you're comfortable with is useful. And then it's about understanding the local context of what you are getting into as much as anything. So each place has its own specific problems.
All right, so grad school. Right on.
I think we're done.
Oh, yep. We're done.
Great. No worries.
Awesome. Fuck Sesta.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.